Charlie and a few of their friends. Chug a couple beers and talk politics. It's better with your two beers in.
Hello, welcome to Two Beers In, a tipsy political roundtable. I'm your co-host, Cody Lindquist.
And I'm Charlie Todd. This week we have artist and activist Steve Lambert on the show, and we're going to drink a couple of beers with him and discuss the intersection of art and activism.
Yep. Our next live show is going to be Monday, March 27th at 8 p.m., UCB Theater East, and tickets are available now at ucbtheater.com.
Yeah, so if you're in New York, come check out that show. And if you're not in New York, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast so you can listen to it later. So we're here with Steve. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks.
Hi, Steve.
To give a little bio on Steve, Steve is an artist who has made international news with works like the New York Times Special Edition and Capitalism Works for Me. He is also the co-founder of the Center for Artistic Activism. Steve is an associate professor at SUNY Purchase. Steve, thanks again for joining us.
And, thank you.
Taking the train down from Beacon.
Yeah.
We have to write all of that intro down because at our live shows, we're drunk and the intros are always a huge mess.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to, this is another special episode where we're going to talk about sort of someone's work and someone's expertise while we drink two beers.
Yeah. We're drinking Azaka IPA Founders.
Azaka? I don't. Yeah, it's the name of the hop. I think it's a single hop IPA from Founders Azaka India Pale Ale in these very nice cans.
Really beautiful, Charlie. Good pick.
Thanks.
This is my first beer in years.
Is it really?
Yeah. I've been going to meetings and stuff.
Oh, God. Oh, no. I was like, oh, no. Cut it off.
I usually drink hard liquor.
Oh, so this will feel
Do you
like
drink
nothing.
More liquor than beer? You don't drink beer frequently?
No, and I don't drink that much. So I'm two beers is like I'm going to be talking a lot.
Yeah, well, these are 7% alcohol beer. So it's good that we're going to have this first conversation while
and
you're
this
sober.
This is a podcast, so people can't see, but you have a very lovely large beard. I would just assume that you would be a beer drinker.
Someone did a casting call for craft brewer,
you could be
for like a Sam Adams commercial.
Yeah. Just some Sam overalls Adams. And me with a lot of stainless steel.
Yeah, there you go.
My little brother has a beer vlog, and he has a nice big beard, too.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You know, I have not said this, clarified this in public in a long time, but I've had this for 17 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
It looks
what would
great.
You say? That's like a 5-inch beard? Is that?
I don't know.
How do you measure
do
a beard?
Do you trim it?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, if you have 17 years, it would be down to your...
yeah, I'd trip
yes.
over it.
I'd like to say it's braided and wrapped around your head several times. So, wow, that's great. That's
but
commitment.
Yeah, so way before the craft brewers and all that.
Yeah, those people are lame.
So do you sort of resent the, like, the newly bearded...
No, I'm like, that's cute, you know, look at you.
Charlie's always had a beard since I've known him.
Yeah.
I mean, you get down to
I'm
the
stubble.
I'm
mostly a stubble guy now.
Yeah.
But now we're two beards in, guys.
Oh, boy. All right, so moving on. So, Steve, we want to talk about a lot of the awesome projects that you've done and how your work uses humor to sort of, I think the artistic statements you make are always sort of tempered with humor. And the activism work that you do always makes me laugh in some way or has, you know, a funny point of view, which I think
I hope
that,
that's the goal.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of activism is very specifically unfunny, even though I may agree with it. I think it's important. And even think it's great. It's,
or intentionally humorless.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And awful.
Yeah. Sometimes
well, we're comedians.
I mean,
so
the issues
we like
are
the...
bad enough. You know, like, and then you have to be so serious about it. It's like,
right. So the first project I wanted to talk with was, you know, one of the, I think the first, maybe when we met, I think,
probably.
Was a project in 2008 called the New York Times Special Edition.
Yes.
And you and a lot of people collaborated on this, but you and the Yes Men were sort of the chief conspirators, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And this was,
And we dragged you into our conspiracy.
Yes. And I got
and
to,
it was a conspiracy.
I got to go to a secret meeting. I think I recommended Peter McManus Bar which was the big UCB bar. And I remember a big secret meeting in the back room of Peter McManus where we talked about this.
And we also, there was another diner too. I remember being in the
diner. Oh yeah. Diner. Yeah.
Yeah.
With
our overcoats and our briefcases.
We switched briefcases.
I was just thinking, so typical Charlie to recommend a meeting point that's within like a 10 block radius of your apartment.
Well, that's how you show your commitment. Yeah. I will come to you. Yes.
Charlie, I don't know if our listeners know, this sounds stupid, but mm-hmm. I don't know if our listeners know about your other project.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess we don't talk about improv everywhere a lot.
This sounds this weird podcast, because this is your career.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess there could be some people who listen to this and don't know that. But yeah, so I run the group Improv Everywhere, which does, you know, pranks, often unauthorized performances in public spaces. So I was brought on by Steve and the Yes Men to join a big team of people to kind of brainstorm this. But I can't take too much credit for anything other than being at a few meetings and offering my two
cents. Offering Peter McManus Cafe. Obviously.
And I recommended the bar to me. Yeah. No, but so let's talk about what this was. You guys, this was a fake edition of the New York Times that came out. It was a couple of weeks after Obama was elected.
1 week after the election.
1 week after he was elected. And this looked and felt like an actual New York Times.
Yes.
How many copies were printed?
80,000.
Wow.
Which we took the...
Is that the real number or the number that was
No,
quoted?
The number that we told the press was 1.2 million.
Oh, that's close.
And it was that was reported as fact because...
Yeah.
That's on the press if
you, there's a video of me on like CNN headline news where the woman is like, you printed 1.4... I forget. We made up some numbers. Yeah. Like, you printed 1.4 million of these... And I'm like just struggling not to laugh because I was like, you believe that? Like, and someone actually debunked it and figured out that the Times doesn't even print 1.4 million, you know, like that, how much money it would cost and space it would take up was ridiculous.
But not to take away from the fact that you printed 80,000 newspapers.
Yeah, 80,000 is what matched the distribution of like Metro or AM New York. Like we tried to figure out how many they distribute in a day.
And it was distributed much like Metro and AM New York, where there was a volunteer crew all over the city who was passing these newspapers out for free. Hey, who wants a free New York Times at like sort of the top of subways?
Hundreds of people on the street.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if you were exiting the subway, you know, anywhere in Manhattan, I'm sure other boroughs too, you were offered a free New York Times. So talk about what the content of.
So the paper was 14 pages of news dated 9 months after the election.
So it was like July of 2009.
Yeah. And we were in November of 2008. And all best case scenario, like business section, local section, national section, talking about this future world that could be. And none of the stories were like, and then Obama did this thing for us because Obama's great. It was... about how people pressured him and, you know, they were forced to make these moves.
Yeah, the message was sort of, we got Obama, that's great. Now let's hold his feet to the fire. Now let's get to work.
Yeah.
And if we all work together, we could achieve this. I remember the front, the image, like the main marquee image was like a helicopter, like the last helicopter leaving Iraq, which I don't know when that actually happened. And I know that we're still sort of there.
I just know that we scooped the Times.
That you
by several years.
You reported the end of the Iraq War several years before it happened.
Yeah.
Was there anything notable that you had in your paper that came true?
Yeah, there was simple stuff like, you know, more bike lanes.
Yeah.
At the time we were demanding, and then that happened. But then I remember walking down the street and seeing in a newspaper box, you know, maximum wage for, or something like wage limits for TARP funded companies.
Yeah.
And we had in our thing like a maximum wage law. Mm-hmm. So there would be a minimum and maximum wage. It was 10 times. It was based on like this labor research and stuff.
Yeah.
And that of all the things to become real, like within a few years was this cap, like maximum wage thing.
Like, yeah.
I would never have guessed this.
So that's one question I wanted to ask you. Now that we are a little bit more than 8 years after this project, How did you feel about how did Obama do? How did our country do?
We didn't live up to what we proposed.
We didn't get it.
Paper.
We didn't get it all done in nine months.
Read the whole paper and just say like, this is the blueprint. Get it done.
We did. You know, we did try to get it to him, and we delivered it to all the offices of the senators and congresspeople in D.C.
We're given a copy of it.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
And I gave it to somebody who knew Reggie Love, who is Obama's bodyguard.
Oh.
And gave a copy for Reggie and a copy for Obama and wrote a note on a 3x5 card to Obama, which I have no idea if he ever saw, but it was a very weird thing to do.
Wow.
And but yeah, I mean, we that was what we wanted. Of course, not everything in there happened.
Right.
But, you know.
In fact, the Tea Party is what was going on in July of 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't have many complaints. You know, yeah. Like, I mean, if we tried, I could. I'm not a big fan of drones yep. and things like that, but you know, I'm a reasonable person and kind of like, I'm sure that job is a lot more complicated than I'll ever know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
What, I mean, it's like Trump found out recently, no one knew that healthcare was complicated, you
exactly.
know, until you sit in that chair.
Yeah. Mm. Could have guessed.
A real genius could have guessed that one.
So that project was a little bit of a hoax, right? I mean, that sort of the goal was maybe not to permanently fool anyone, but to have people getting off the subway who were receiving this paper to kind of do a double take. Obviously, no one was going to think it was presently July 2009 when it was, you know,
I
my goal November
was very, very hungover. And
my
confused.
Goal is like 15 seconds of, whoa, you know, like, is this, oh my gosh, you know. Right. And like to let people feel that excitement about how great it could be. And then once they figured it out, to not feel like the joke had been, there was a joke that was played on them.
Right.
That instead they got to experience this thing and that they could share it.
Yeah.
Right? And so for the most part, that's what happened. You know, when you're distributing tens of thousands, I'm sure there was somebody that was pissed. But I have a feeling they're probably pissed about something.
Yeah, they got a free paper. Listen.
Yeah.
Right? I was like, come on. The New York Times is expensive. Did you have a crossword puzzle?
I don't think we did.
Oh,
we had
man.
Ads. We had ads for jewelry and stuff. Like De Beers Diamond Company. I don't know if I told you all this
stuff. You get sued, right?
Yeah. Well, they De Beers tried to.
Because De Beers is like blood diamonds.
Yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. They have a long history. And
weren't they what Blood Diamond that movie was about?
I never saw it.
I haven't seen it either.
De Beers, I think they're the people that own. Yeah, they'll come after you.
Yeah, yeah.
They came after me.
Just kidding. JK, guys. JK.
But I'm pretty sure you know, people at home can like look and tell me how wrong I am. But I'm pretty sure they were the ones that kind of made diamonds diamonds, right? Mean what they do in the culture. And after buying up all the mines in South Africa, which... You know, you could imagine the other things that were at play. So we made this ad where there would be the jewelry ads inside the front page. And this I'm still so proud of. And so it's a woman wearing a ring, reaching out and holding another hand. And it says from her hand to his something, something. I can't remember now. And then it's like, for every diamond sold between now and 2075, De Beers will give money to... use all the profits to fit people who lost limbs in the diamond conflicts, you know, fit them with prosthetic limbs, buy the prosthetic limbs, maintain them. And so the woman's holding this other hand and the hand is like a prosthetic. Hand.
Wow.
So and they ads, really wow. didn't like that.
So the ads,
they were like, no, we're not doing that.
The ads were also aspirational. Like,
yes.
We could live in a world where corporations took responsibility and gave back.
Well, they are people. They should take back. They're people.
That's very much in the, in the tradition of the Yes Men, of, you know, of the Yes Men coming out and pretending to be a Dow Chemical spokesperson on the BBC and saying Dow's going to, you know, pay back all these people who have been adversely affected by their chemical spill or...
Yeah.
So that's great. I love that. And I imagine that the project had a much bigger effect than the 80,000 people that got the newspaper. I mean, it was covered all over the world.
We melted down the servers. Like I think in the first day there were 300,000 people.
Because there was a website too, right? There was
Times website.
NewYorkTimes.biz? What was it?
No, it's nytimes-se.com, which I think it's still up. Every once in a while I check and like things break, but
yeah.
I still own nytms.com if anybody wants to buy that.
Just the New York Times without the vowels?
Yeah.
Like sort of the Tumblr generation version of the
New York Times? Yeah, because we were going to use that, and then we decided to use nytimes.se for special edition.
And wasn't it replicated? Was there one in Germany or something?
Oh, there have been a lot of fake papers after that. Yeah. And
that you didn't personally work on, but just
no, I didn't work on any of the other ones. The Yes Men did two other ones. Okay. And one I couldn't get involved in, and the other one I didn't think was going to work as well. And so I didn't spend time on it. And it just between us didn't work as well. But because as soon as we did it, I was like, this can never be repeated. It won't have the same effect.
Right.
But there were some interesting, like in Germany and England did one, Poland. Sometimes they would contact us and we would kind of talk them through it a little bit. But one of the fascinating ones was in Egypt, and it was after the Tahrir Square thing.
Wow.
And they had this sort of big explosion, and then we're like, it kind of collapsed, right? And so they made this, they had this day that was organized with all these news agencies and advertisers and stuff where they were talking about the news a year in the future and what could be happening there. And so all the ads and all the TV media and radio media were doing this, and they made a newspaper also.
Wow.
The kind of lousy part of it was like all for advertisers to sort of get the economy going again.
Mm.
But you know,
you need that, I guess.
Yeah.
So if you were
it's
to
nice
do
to be
a,
influential,
if you were to do a special edition of the New York Times tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
What would that be in the Trump era?
And also, is Trump actually the president, or have you just been playing us in the news for the last 6 weeks?
It feels like a hoax.
We're just like brought you here to like make sure that Trump presidency isn't a hoax.
One of my favorite signs after he was elected was this Black Mirror episode sucks. So we were working with Greenpeace like in January before the inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
And
when you say we, the
Center for Artistic Activism, doing a training with them. And one of the things I said, I was like, all right, so what do we want? Like, what are we working towards here? And we were talking. And so what went up on the wall was Trump is not the president in 4 years or sooner.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, sooner, you know, and I'm like, yeah, why not? Right. Like if we're dreaming here.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of it. It's like I still believe this. It might be a coping mechanism, but, you know, the odds are not high that he will make it through the whole 4 years.
I like to think that. I mean, I like to think
there's a presidential historian recently wrote an op-ed about that, just statistically based on. I clearly didn't read it well enough, so I'm just going to walk this back. But he was saying that based on this type of presidency we've already seen and his numbers, that statistically there's a good chance he won't make it through. And I agree. I don't know how we can sustain this for 4 years. And we've talked about this too, like, you know, knock on wood, but things are good right now and it's so chaotic. I can't imagine. You know,
you mean we're not at war, we're not in a recession.
Right. I mean, you know, good in a
I mean, by
relative.
The way, we are at war. I think we're still in war in Afghanistan, but everyone's forgotten.
There's no immediate crisis looming at the moment besides the fact that our planet's dying and other things. So it's scary to think, like, I don't know how this
how he
last.
Would take advantage of a crisis.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on from Trump for a little bit. although I'm about to bring it right back. Wanted to talk about another project of yours, Steve, which is, I think, maybe the first project of yours that I ever came across, which is something you did, I think, first in 2006, which is called I Will Talk to Anyone About Anything.
Oh, yes.
And so what Steve did for this is he set up a card table. Was it Union Square? Was it somewhere in Manhattan?
No, it was. I did grad school at UC Davis.
Okay. Oh, it was out in California.
Yeah. And it was on a college campus, and there were all these tables. Like, it's state university.
So it's like sign up for this club, that club, or.
No, it's for outsiders, right?
Okay.
So mostly. And so they have to have this area where the public can come. And if you're recruiting for the military or trying to get people not to have abortions or whatever it is, you set up, or you want to give your free literature for your weird religion, you set up at those tables.
So if you want to do all three at one table, you're welcome to do that. That's Scientology.
And so walking by there, I was always like, don't make eye contact. You know, like I do. And everyone, you know, it was where you would get food. And that was sort of the general, like, look away.
Yeah.
Don't get caught up in talking about what these people want to talk about with you. And I just had this thought, which was like, if they wanted to talk to me about, I don't mind talking, it just, I don't want to talk about your free literature or joining the military, you know?
Right.
So if they wanted to talk to me about what I wanted to talk about, then I would be into it. And so it's like, well, why don't I make that? And so I just really quickly made this sign that said, I will talk with anyone about anything for free, and then set up. And what, it worked in two ways. One was visually, people would just look at it and start laughing.
The image is so great. I mean, just the photo project, main project photograph of you behind a table with that big hand drawn sign.
Yeah.
I will talk to anyone about anything.
But then there's two other ways it was successful. One is like people would line up and I would be like, oh, you two are in line. Like, what do you want to talk about? And they would say, I want to talk about this. What do you want? Okay, why don't you two talk to each other? And then they would start talking and it would just be a bunch of people standing around talking.
That's great.
And what was funny too is they were like afraid that I was going to talk their ear off and monopolize the whole thing. But I was the one that was stuck behind the table. So I'm like, oh, please don't be insane when they would walk up to me, you know?
Yeah.
But then the other part about it is that it's been repeated in so many different countries. Mm-hmm. And the image, like, was funny when I was in school. I keep telling my students this because they see that picture come up online because it's a very popular picture online.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, Professor Lambert, I saw your picture. You know, you're on the internet. I'm like, I know. You
know, like, well, you're on the internet, man.
12 years.
Is it a meme? Like, is it used?
Yeah, it gets, well,
as a non sequitur.
I have a higher standard of what a meme is. Okay. Like, captioning photos to me is not a meme.
But that's called captioning.
Sorry, is it an image macro sometimes?
Yeah. So sometime now it was on Reddit, on the front page of Reddit, I think yesterday or the day before.
Yesterday?
Yeah, because somebody changed.
Very timely that we brought this up.
Yeah. Somebody changed that I will argue with anyone about anything. And wow. Jason Alexander from Seinfeld posted it on his Twitter. And so it's like this whole other thing now that I have, I don't know, it's kind of.
Do you look a lot different now than you did back then? So
kinda
then,
look,
you know,
the same. Yeah.
Well, then, hey.
But I tell my students, relevant. I'm like, my professors and all my other master students and stuff are like, what are you doing? We don't get it. You know, and I'm like, no, this is funny. Right. Like,
when you did it?
Yeah. At the time. Yeah. They're like, this is dumb. You know, and I'm like, no, there's something here.
Yeah,
I know it.
This is going to be an image macro one day.
Well, those didn't exist at the time. But I just insisted, you know, and I was like, I don't care what you think. I know this is good. And it took like 2 or 3 years before somebody picked it up on the internet. And then it just like went all over the place.
Not that you did it for 2 or 3 years, but just
you
did it. You documented it and it went viral later.
Yeah.
Just also.
Wow.
It's so disturbing. I never thought about this, but I was just, you know, thinking about the booths that you would have at schools.
Yeah,
I never thought about that. But like we had all these booths at our my high school, my college to recruit you for the Army and all the stuff.
Yeah. I mostly remember credit card companies.
Too. And how insane is that? Like you're 18. I mean, now I can look back and be like, I'm an adult. I could refuse a credit card offer, but they were, getting kids into debt.
I have so
and
many
signing
free
them
t-shirts.
Up for war.
Yeah. Like,
I would just give fake information and get a free t-shirt.
Well, you were smart, Charlie. Good for you. Congratulations. So
the question that I wanted to ask, political question I wanted to ask about this project is, I mean, that seems like an extreme exercise in listening.
Yeah.
And perhaps empathy.
And it was helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't really want to listen to Trump voters, but I know that I guess we should to try to figure out what went wrong and to try to figure out how we can better communicate to people who voted for somebody with a personality disorder. And so I don't know, just open ended question here, but is there anything that you feel like you learned from that project about listening or empathy that could be, I mean, have you been listening to Trump voters and do we need to, and what is there to learn?
I live in a really great bubble, you know, and I'm also like, I'm not as social as I was when I was younger. No, it's like me and my partner in our house with the cat. That's mostly it.
Is your cat a Trump supporter or?
the cat does not give a fuck.
Cat don't give a fuck.
But so I don't know that I don't know who I know that's a Trump supporter. Yeah. Right. Which is.
Where are you from originally?
California.
Okay. So yeah. So yeah.
Bay Area.
Yeah.
You know, I bet there's some family members of mine because my mom had 12 brothers and sisters. So just one statistically. Of
them, statistically,
yeah,
for right. sure.
Yeah. One of them I know is a dick and probably. but one or two. But anyway, I still, between that and like the capitalism sign too, it's a lot of talking to people about stuff that right. I don't necessarily agree with, but it's sort of with both of those. Yeah. I think I still can carry on a conversation with someone that I don't agree with. And one of the things about talking to so many people, cause I've in the course of these projects talked to thousands of people about mm-hmm. sometimes very volatile political stuff. Mm-hmm. They don't really care about what any one person thinks or if they leave agreeing with me because
you don't have to win every argument.
No, yeah. You know, and so it sort of becomes a game for me of trying to get them to have a real conversation instead of repeating stuff that they've said before or that they've heard right. and to like really reflect and get them off of a track that they're on, right? So when the capitalism sign says capitalism works for me and it has a true false scoreboard.
Yeah, yeah, this is the next project yeah. we want to talk yeah. about, so that's a good segue. So Steve made this giant like scoreboard size sculpture
yeah.
With sort of scoreboard style score yeah. numbers and it says capitalism works for me, and there's one side that says true and there's one side that says false, and then there's a button that one can press yeah. to choose true or false, yep. or two buttons. And you would put this in a public square. It would tour around the country or the world
yep.
and just keep a running tally in a community of whether or not capitalism works for those for that have person. Chosen, yeah. chosen to vote.
And so part of it says works for me because the first thing people want to do is make it about capitalism working in general,
right?
Which is sort of more vague, but a right. much easier question to answer. Or, you know, like the other thing that libertarians like to do is like, does pure capitalism work? And it's like, yeah, because it's hypothetical.
Cause yeah.
It's never existed. Right? Yeah. You know, just like to me, anarchism right. works because, you know, right. like, yeah, in my imagination, you know,
if everyone was like me, anarchism might work.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So so they would come and, you know, say sometimes I would even try to get the people that because, you know, I'd kind of for me, capitalism has not worked. So well, I kind of make it work. But when people would say, no, it doesn't work, I'd be like, well, what do you mean? Why not? And then, you know, say like, you have this nice shirt and you're like, yeah. you're here in New York City. And like,
so you're sort of playing devil's advocate.
Yeah. Too. And so that they would be like, no, I remember this woman, I was like, you have such a wonderful outfit and you're here in New York City. How could it not be working for you? And she's like, I'm trying to get a job. I've been unemployed for like, you know, 3 months or something. And I was like, all right, fair enough, you know. And yeah. then so then we'd have this conversation or like that guy came up to me one time in a 3-piece suit with a cigar. And I was like, I know what you're going to press. And he's like, how do you know? And I'm like, look at you, you know, and, yeah. and they so don't expect that I would be making the like right. overt judgments about how they look.
Sure.
And so they're just like, wait, what is this?
Yeah.
You know, and I'd be like, I think you're about true. You got a big cigar. You got a suit. You got that nice red tie. And he's like, no, I'm not. And I was like, you look like a business guy. He's like, I'm a conductor of the New Jersey Symphony, you know? And I was like, wow, okay. So what do you think? You know, and then I would get down into the economic stuff. Yeah. And I'm like, how has it worked for you? Like you're a musician, right? Like that's gotta be a little bit tricky.
Right.
And keep bringing it back to their life and their experience so that we weren't having an abstract political argument.
Well, that is so important because I think one of the biggest problems we have now is that people in theory think these things are working, but they're not, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, I if you can't pay for health insurance, you know, you're losing your job, you think that big business will help you, right? Like in some abstract way that cutting regulations or whatever is going to help yeah. you
make jobs.
Right.
And you'll get that job.
And then you'll get that job. But when you really put it on this level of like, let's look at actually what's happening right now and what is working for you.
Yeah.
Is it, or is it not? So it's really interesting. And I think it is important that we're having these conversations with people. I wish I were around more, people to talk politics with that didn't agree with everything I said, because I think it's more that we are so hyper partisan at this point that like we're demonizing people on both sides rather than listening and realizing that people vote a specific way for a reason. Mm-hmm. And that like, if we can connect and show them that, you know, I don't think that everybody, you know, I'm not a complete socialist or whatever. I mean, you can just sort of see that you have more in common than you don't.
Yeah.
Well, did you find that? So you give an example of someone who voted no, and you're sort of playing devil's advocate saying, don't you really mean yes? Were there people that voted yes who were sort of actually not doing well? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of Trump voters.
Yeah. I had a homeless guy say that it worked for him. And I was like, really? You know, I wanted to understand. And unfortunately, I never was able to understand. But, you know, there were people that would say, yeah, it works for me. And I'd say, right now. And they're like, well, no, I mean, I want it to. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about right now.
I think a lot of people vote Republican aspirationally.
Like, yeah.
You know, I'm voting because, you know, one day I'm going to win the lottery. One day I'm going to have that money. I don't want the government taking that, those millions that I'm going to make hypothetically years down the road.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I feel like I understand the Trump voter who wants his taxes cut and doesn't want the estate tax because they have $10 billion. But I have a harder time understanding the Trump voter who doesn't have a job, or the Republican voter. I mean, I guess Trump gave lip service to all those people. So
we didn't do an adequate job addressing people that are losing their jobs. And unemployment is super low. I get it. But also, good jobs are gone and they're not coming back no matter what he says. You're not getting your lucrative factory job back. We're going to have to figure out another job for everybody to have. Right. But we didn't do a good enough job explaining that we care and that we're trying to find ways for people to work.
I think Bernie Sanders did a pretty good job at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did.
You know, I think there are certain people that know how to speak to that.
But I don't really think he spoke well to minority voters.
But Killer Mike did.
Yes, he did. He did.
That's true.
That is 100% true.
I don't want to do Bernie Hillary because we've talked about it to death for years in this podcast. Yeah. But quickly, do you think Bernie could have beaten Trump?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, like, that was the problem, right?
Even as we have a wave of anti-Semitism in our country right now. And
I think that there's he would have been perceived differently. Right. And there's a way that you can talk about socialism in an abstraction about it being like, you know, they're trying to take your freedom. Right. And then there's a way you can talk about socialism as a real advocate of socialism where people are like, makes sense. I get it. There was a group of artists called the Propeller Group that made this amazing commercial for communism. They hired an advertising company to make an ad for communism.
They're based in the U.S., this group?
I don't know. They're from all over the place.
Okay.
I really wish I could have auditioned for that.
Yeah, but you watch like a 1-minute thing where, you know, it's for the new communism. And at the end, it's like, yeah, seems good.
Yeah.
You know,
why not?
And seems they include like from each according to their ability, to each according to their need and stuff like that. But it's like got this, you know, it's made by an advertising company. And so it's compelling. And I think, you know, the part of the way that people perceive socialism is that they're going to take this thing from me instead of we're going to give so much more to everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, that like socialism is abundance for everyone instead of abundance for just a few people. And in other countries, they do a better job of that, you know. And I guess that's why the other thing is that politics here is framed and being a part of politics is perceived in a certain way that seems really boring and like a scam, right? Like all the politicians are out to get us.
Yeah.
They're all liars. They're all cheats, you know, and that's our only real experience with politics.
Right.
And that's rooted in a real thing. But that's why I think the work that I try to do and that we do at the Center for Artistic Activism and like working with these groups is like, no, politics has to be something that people understand in this like emotional gut level. They have to be moved to do it the same way they're moved by artworks.
I think that is the biggest takeaway from this election and from Trump winning is that people really do vote with their gut and that you need to do exactly what Bernie did, which is really just boil it down to one thing, right? Like Bernie was so on message and so he really got people excited in the same way that Donald Trump did.
You don't think Stronger Together is one thing?
I like Stronger
Together. I do like Stronger Together. I'm being facetious, but I do.
I found that there was a this is a sign that to me that was good. There was some soccer team in, I want to say New Zealand or something. Mm-hmm. And their like motto was Together Stronger.
Oh.
Ooh.
So if Hillary would have flipped it, she would have won.
Together Stronger.
Is there a comma? Is there a comma there or just is this
No, it's just Together Stronger. But if it works for like a soccer team,
it's
got potential.
I mean I was one of the only people that was inspired by Hillary, I guess.
I was inspired by Hillary.
I was inspired by her. But so now in this era of Trump, I think artistic expression is more important than ever, mm-hmm. or at least I hope it is.
Some of it's bullshit.
Yeah. Well, please.
The one beer is starting to take effect.
I'm not saying every single thing that people do is relevant and important, but I do think that we are finding ways to reach out to people and to communicate with people. And I think that art is a great way to do that. Cause if people find your art funny and moving and it makes them think, then, you know, there is merit in that. But what do you think people that want to be active, what are some things you think they can be doing creatively?
Oh, there's a ton. And I think the part of it is not thinking of artists as somebody that went to art school or shows in museums or galleries. You know, it's like creativity.
I mean, I do have a degree in theater, so I'm really, really qualified.
That's helpful. Yeah,
very helpful.
But you know, the instincts that make you a good sort of part-time DJ on the weekends, or someone who knows how to throw a good dinner party or like a good dancer, the untrained, you know, those are things that help activists also, or activist efforts. And there's like part of the problem of activism is that the tradition has such weight and strength.
Right.
So I was talking to students about this today. Like when you think of activism, you think of like a few things, sit-ins, marches, boycotts, right? These things that, that's worked. That's activism. That's how you do it. We do a sit-in, we do a march. We do boycotts, right?
Right.
But every example of those that were successful, right? It's Greensboro sit-ins in North Carolina in the, going back before the 60s, but say mid-60s. That was like, they were trying to get photos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of them in suits. There's costumes, right? There's a set, there's a stage, they want that meme, right? Yeah, in a way. And they want images in the media of like, we are reasonable people,
right?
And trying to get service at this lunch counter, and these people won't serve us. Black dignity, white racism, you know. And then in like Birmingham, it's like black dignity versus white brutality, right?
Right.
Police brutality. And the purpose was not to have a march or to do a sit-in. That was part of it. But the goal was to create an image and communicate an idea to the wider world of something that was kind of invisible, right?
Right.
Not,
I mean, Rosa Parks was her. There's more to that story, right? I mean, that was deliberate.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like she was a secretary of the NAACP.
Right.
She, her dad was a Garveyite. Like she was trained, right? And they actually did that bus thing like with a different person a year before, but she was younger. She was darker skinned and got pregnant shortly after. And they're like, this isn't the character we want to go with. Right.
Yeah.
So
she was recast and Rosa Parks got the role.
Rosa Parks, right? Yeah. Older woman, lighter skin for whatever that's worth. But yeah, she knew what she was doing. And the photo, like the iconic photo that you think of your in your mind of her sitting on the bus, was taken a year later.
Mm.
They went and staged the picture. And it's not a staged photo in that it's fake. It's a staged photo in that it's...
It wasn't when she originally did it.
Yeah, it's like it's staging the reality, right? Instead of staging a fiction. So there's all this dramaturgy.
So much for speaking to my degree.
Yeah. In that successful mm-hmm. activism.
Right.
All of it is like creative. All of it's artistic. All of it's thinking about spectacles and symbols and how to leverage those. If you think back on what was successful activism in terms of like women's suffrage or the American Revolution, there's always these artistic elements, but we don't think of the process of how they got to that idea and what worked.
That somebody had a meeting and thought about it, planned it out.
Yeah. And
for months and months and months.
How do we communicate this? What's the goal? And what's the best way for us to get to that? And the mistake that I think even experienced people, which is very frustrating, make is they look and they go, okay, this is how we do this. You know, at Greenpeace, the joke is like, okay, well, what do? We make a banner. We drop a banner, you know, and to the point where they're
the
like,
one on the crane behind the White House was pretty cool.
Amazing. Yeah,
yeah. That was
and
great.
We were, like I said, we were there in early January and they're like, it's a banner, but take a look. This is what we're thinking about doing. I'm like, it's good. Don't beat yourself.
That was an epic banner.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's kind of like their go-to thing. Yeah. So anyway, the traditions of what activism is get understood as sort of like the definition instead of it's not the expression, it's the process.
Right.
And when you take the process and say, okay, let's think about the goals or the objectives of the political objectives, right? But you have to be kind of creative and visionary in order to imagine a world outside the reality that we're in,
mm-hmm.
like a world where Trump is impeached. It takes some work to imagine how that happens or what it would be like, or how Trump loses in 2020. If that happens, you know, like how that stuff to imagine that world takes some vision. And artists sometimes are better at that, but all kinds of people can do that, you know, like it's just sort of allowing a space where you can envision this other world. That's what we did with that newspaper. It's hard, you know, but it's hard also not to go cynical.
Right.
That's easier. It's like, you know, dystopias are much easier to imagine than utopias.
So we need hope.
Yeah.
Hope
but it's true. I mean, we look at Obama, and part of the reason Obama was successful and won, I mean, that we all bought into that. I mean, and I'm not saying it wasn't true, but that feeling of hope and the way you went to feel you felt when you voted for him was just unprecedented for people our generation or the generation below us. And well, so
especially what he was coming after.
Yeah.
Too.
And so
I talked very vocally on this podcast about how when Hillary was going to win, we were all going to go party in the streets and it was going to be great, because I forever want to recreate the feeling that I had when Obama won in 2008, one of the greatest nights in New York.
Yeah, it was crazy.
But I feel like November 2020 has the potential to be
a bigger party,
even better. So,
November 2024 or
25? No, that's too easy.
Did you just give Trump like a 9-year term?
I'm just saying, listen, I want to be realistic, and we got to fight.
That's not realistic,
Steve. I want to talk about one more thing before we wrap this episode up, which is the DeVos family in Michigan, because you have a personal connection.
Connection.
I'm sorry, you have a story about the DeVos.
Your real last name is DeVos. You pulled off the head.
You had a bit of a run-in with the DeVos family, maybe.
Yeah.
So the DeVos family, of which Betsy DeVos is part of,
married into,
is wealthy plutocrats in Michigan.
I'm so glad you remembered this.
Oh yeah. Well, it's even more relevant now than it was when it all happened. So, and I think the patriarch of that family was started Amway, or mm-hmm.
Which is the original pyramid scheme,
which is a multi-level marketing scheme. Also, they married into the family that owns Blackwater. Yep. Is that right? And then they're
this is like the worst villainous family.
Yeah, they are. Well, you look at Betsy DeVos. She looks like Cruella DeVille. I mean, she's such a villain. But I don't know if it's Rick DeVos her son
or
they're all called Rick DeVos.
All right, there's a bunch of DeVos's. There's one guy that's like around our age who's named Rick DeVos.
Yeah. Hey, our son's Charles. This guy's Charlie.
But
nothing
this,
wrong with naming everyone this the same name.
Particular Rick DeVos runs a successful art festival called Art Prize, which. I had heard about it. In fact, Improv Everywhere did an MP3 experiment project at Art Prize years ago.
Oh, okay.
My collaborator went to it, and I didn't really know anything about it other than it's an art festival in Michigan that wants to pay me a little bit of money to do a project.
That was how we went into it. Yeah.
So you got invited. Was it for Capitalism Works for Me?
Yep.
So,
and it was by the Ferris State University. So I got invited by a curator at the university who wanted to kind of mess with Art Prize. She had me and this guy, Bill Pauhida, and he makes like pretty scathing work about the art world in general and financial markets and stuff. And she knew probably that he would do something about DeVos also. I don't think she knew what I was going to do. Nobody did.
So you were brought in knowing like there is a conservative family that you didn't know.
I mean,
the person that invited you knew.
Yeah. And she was trying to put together a show. She's like, all right, this thing is happening anyway. Let's make the best show we can.
And it's happened for many years. It has a long history and
it's
Ann Arbor.
Like 7 years. No, not Ann Arbor.
Oh, okay.
Ann Arbor is super liberal. It's in Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids, Michigan.
So they set this thing up, and there's a lot of problems with the way that they set it up. But it was meant to sort of, you know, disrupt, in quotes, the way that art is evaluated and make it, you know, democratized and popularized. So the idea is all these people come and set up work, and they're all vying for a shot at a $250,000 prize.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone through this iPhone app, you go around and you vote on the work that you like the best.
You go check out art in various galleries or live performances and you vote.
Yeah, and whatever you like, you punch into your phone and they total it up. That alone, I like, right? Like, it's like, that seems cool. That I don't have a problem with. But their motivation was to sort of say that the role of critics and, you know, the art establishment is getting in the way. This should be done by real people. That I don't agree with as much. I like the idea of accounting for the audience and thinking about real people. So anyway, they have this huge prize. The first year they did this with this like open voting thing, the work that won was a portrait of Jesus that was on the cross portrayed by some LA surfer.
What?
No joke. That was the model.
There's so many layers.
In front of like a lake or so, or some body of water, right?
In Grand Rapids, one of the Great Lakes.
Yeah. Not a commentary on Christianity, just a Christian art piece.
Yeah. And what they figured out early on is things that rose to the top were like paintings of water and religious stuff.
Is there it's only popular vote, or is there also like a jury?
The first year was only popular vote, and it was pretty embarrassing.
Because
Jesus Surfer won. Jesus won. Yeah, Surfer Jesus. So,
Did it win because the people there are so conservative? Or because,
yes, it is a very conservative place. Partly because the DeVos family's influence.
They're running the schools. They're making everyone religious. Yeah. Welcome to the country.
But there's also like, I forget what it's, Calvinist church or something. Some sort of super right-wing church out there. So they were embarrassed. So they started to bring in jurors, and they had two prizes. One was like the juror's prize. One was the popular prize. And so I came in like 6 years into it or something, and I had heard about it.
This is like 2 years ago, right?
Yeah. Two years ago, probably. And so anyway, I went out there and they asked me to give a talk. And it's like a normal thing I do. And also, I'd like rather show the capitalism sign anywhere than have it in my garage. So, like, let's get in front of some people. So I got there and I gave this. And as I was there, I started to learn more about, they're like, yeah, this thing is happening, but you have to know about the DeVos family. And like finding out from local people what the influence that they had, what they were doing, who Richard DeVos, the owner, was. He was on Reagan's AIDS commission and is sort
of. Oh, God.
Yeah. That's not a thing to be proud of.
No.
And
was, even the people that love Reagan are not proud of his AIDS policy.
So the one of the things he was sort of famous for saying is, while he was on the AIDS Commission, is, well, you know, if you have to take responsibility, right? Like, if you're out there, basically, if you're out there having sex with men, if you get AIDS, like, you kind of,
that's on you.
Yeah, it's on you. Right. Yeah. So if you got AIDS, you deserve to die, right? Like, the fact that you are, have sex with men means that you deserve to die.
So you're out in Michigan. You realize that these are the people.
You don't want to linger on that?
These are the people that are going to potentially be giving you $200,000.
Oh, well, yeah. So I'm giving this talk at the university and I'm like, okay, I got to like sort of jar these students and like trying to give them the most information as I possibly can. And at the end of the talk in the Q&A, they're like, by the way, you're on the popular finalists and the jurors finalists.
So you have a real chance of winning.
No.
No, but you're in the, you know, when you find out here, you know, you're in the running.
Technically, I'm a finalist, right? I have like a 1 in 25 chance of winning either of those prizes, but it's not Jesus in front of a lake, right? Like, I have a piece that's kind of, it's
questioning capitalism.
Yeah.
Did you think about like crossing out capitalism and writing Jesus? Does Jesus work for you?
Yeah, just like, come on, give me the money. and everyone's like, hey, and I'm like, no, I'm not taking this seriously. And so at dinner that night, we were sitting around and I was like, all right, so I have like this one in 20 or something, but like 1 in 20 chance of winning and a 19 in 20 chance of losing, right? And they kept saying while I was there, like, you can't criticize the DeVos family. It doesn't work. Nothing gets through. We've done it for years, right? Like, and they've made works about, like, they've had works in the show that were critical of the show. They've, like, had, people have made whole counter installations that weren't part of it, that were, and news stories and all kinds of stuff. And they're like, nothing sticks. People are too into it. So then we were sitting there and I was like, no, that's not possible. There's got to be a way, you know? And so I was like, well, what if I said I was going to take the prize money and donate it to a, LGBT center here in Grand Rapids because they're very anti-gay.
Yes.
Right. And like they funded Prop 8 in California, like awful stuff. Right. And there's a ton of homeless LGBT youth in Western Michigan, partly because of that church and the way that their attitude towards homosexuality like drives the kids out of their houses and stuff. Anyway, so I was like, what if I did this? And they were like, that could work, you know? And so the rest of the dinner was like, people would start talking about other stuff and I'm like, wait, what if they said that? What would I do if they did this? You know? And they're like, well, blah, 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 blah. And just like working out the details, and my mind could not stop running on this idea. And this is kind of like how I approach a lot of things, which is, like sort of always training, always trying to be ready, and then looking for the moment where there's an opening and I could just dunk the ball.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, this is it. I could do this, right? And they're like, yeah, but you'd be, you know, like, what if you win? I'm like, I'm not gonna win, you know. And what if I don't do it and I don't win? I'm gonna feel like I lost. I
wasted can't
do
it after, right?
Yeah.
And so I wrote up this letter and made this huge announcement that if I won, I was going to give it to the LGBT Center of Grand Rapids. And first I was afraid that nothing was going to happen, right? Because like it put it out and it takes some time to pick up, you know?
Worst case scenario, you put it out, it doesn't get picked up, but you still win. And then you have to give all the money that you really could have used yourself.
Yeah. Well, we were buying
a
house at the time.
Yeah. And you're like,
I'm
oh, like,
my partner, I'm like, it's okay if we do this, you know, like I could potentially be giving away $250,000.
You're like, capitalism is not working for you at this point.
Which is the house, you know, like we could just own the house.
Yeah.
It's actually my mortgage or the amount I owe on the house is less than that right
now.
Right? So anyway, she's like, yeah, okay, do it. You know, I get it. If that's, yeah, sure. And so I put this thing out and there, you know, for like 4 hours, nothing happens, right? And I'm just like, fuck. You know, I'm like, at least I got to get some, this has to get attention, you know?
Yeah.
And then it started to pick up, and then it was like big news in Michigan. It got covered across the whole state.
Wow.
Because I was like attacking them in a way that they couldn't defend.
Because you weren't saying, I hate their policy, this.
But
you're
I'm going to take that money
I'm giving
anyway.
The money to...
No, I said I hated their policy.
Right. But if you just said that, that wouldn't work.
And I made it really personal. I was like, look, these people believe this thing. I got into the show not really understanding that. And of course, not expecting to win. And now I'm in this position where I could be accepting $250, and I can't live with myself. And
right.
So here's what I'm going to do. And this is a decision I've made because I think it's important. And they can't argue with my own moral thing.
Did they try to argue with you? Did they come after you? Yes. Was there a smear campaign?
Yes.
Oh, what was that?
I couldn't believe it. Because like the smart thing to do is don't respond to my letter.
And then it dies, right?
Yeah. Just be like, you know. Yeah,
you're not going to win anyway.
Yeah. We've seen his letter. And we think it's great that what
we appreciate all opinions at our press.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Like handle it smartly. But instead, they're like, you know, Steve, we think he has some good points and people should know that blah, 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 blah. And like start to sort of like we want to raise the conversation or like we encourage the conversation, which I've heard now from a lot of people. It's like a way of sort of minimizing criticism. It's like, oh, we encourage. Let's keep the conversation going.
Let's right? talk about this thing that I'm doing that's terrible.
Let's have a national dialogue about how terrible what I do is. Let's let people decide on human rights. They did that
and they opened it up. I'm like, great. Let's have a conversation. Here are things I want to know. Mm-hmm. When is Rick DeVos going to speak out against what his grandfather and his father did?
Because this guy that's our age is probably not, doesn't have the same views as his grandfather.
Well, everybody says that. People say that in Grand Rapids. People say that are against our prize, but he doesn't actually put it on the record.
Right. He's the Ivanka Trump of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So I'm like, this guy needs to say something. And, you know, I don't know. So I pushed that. And then they answered again. Right. And I'm like, I can't. You guys are idiots. Like, stop talking to me. And so the director then is like, we take offense at the idea that, you know, we're homophobic. Like within the Art Prize organization, there are, you know, gay and lesbian people.
We don't believe they should get married or have rights.
But the people
in
the organization don't care.
There's nice people and there's diverse people who are working for this arts organization. Yes. They have evil corporate overlords.
Yeah. And then, you know, and my mother does this and blah, blah. And I was like, great. You know, congratulations. You have gay friends. So does the whole world. This is the problem. Like, you know, like you need to address this and brought it back again. And then they wrote back again. Wow. Right. And so I'm like, look, these are, oh, and they kept kind of like trying to muddle what I was saying. So they're like, this is, tell me if this is boring, but they're like, you know, we think it's great that you're giving to the Grand Rapids Community Fund because they support us. And I was like, oh, fuck, what the fuck is this? You know, and like thinking
the LGBT center supports the Art Prize.
Well, I like had to look into it because I'm like, wait, did I fuck up? You know, and so then the LGBT or the Grand Rapids Community Fund is sort of like the bank of foundations. Right. And then in there are accounts like the LGBT fund and other stuff. Right. So they're saying we get money from the bigger group. And I was like, wait, are you getting money from the LGBT fund? Because that's why, you know, and they wouldn't answer. So then I called.
Why is the LGBT fund wasting their money on art?
Yeah.
No offense, guys.
The annoying thing was there were all these people reporting on this sort of scandal, but no one was doing any digging except me. And I'm like, I'm like, this is totally nerve wracking and I'm possibly giving away $250,000, but also I have to make all the phone calls and dig and do the investigation, you know? So I called the Grand Rapids Community Fund and I'm like, hi, they pick up and I'm like, hi, this is Steve Lambert. And they're like, oh, hi, you know, cause like I've pledged to give them $250,000.
What can we do?
Yeah. So I'm like, can I talk to your executive director? And they're like, sure, hold on. You know? So they put me on the phone. They're like, hi, Steve. And I was like, hi, I'm sorry to be communicating it with you under these circumstances. I hope I can give you $250,000. Yeah. And I was like, so did you give money to Art Prize? And they're like, no, they're like, we, the not the LGBT fund, right? Like this thing. And I'm like, what was the money for? And they're like, well, for some wheelchair accessible ramps and Spanish translation of wall text. And they're,
it's
claiming
also just
this.
Like so infuriating. And this is a big problem with the media too. It's like, all it took was you making one phone call to get the truth. But people, I feel like, now don't even take the time to make the phone call or look on someone's website or.
So we have to wrap up. So yeah, you didn't win.
I didn't win.
But the big bonus was that Betsy DeVos became Secretary of Education and everybody, and everyone wins.
Oh, God.
And we're all going to have school choice and we're all going to just.
Thank God you're tenured, you know, because otherwise she'd be coming after your job.
I didn't mean to wrap that up for you. Is there an epilogue?
Did you, well, Rick, fall in love and become gay married?
No, they eventually wised up and stopped allowing me to keep asking them questions. And so I called them out on the sort of basically a lie about, you know, them getting money. And
who did,
like,
win?
Why
that
are you trying
year?
To mislead me?
Jesus on a skateboard?
No, this woman that made this like beautiful lit up sculpture. But it's like nothing super challenging because
she probably bought a house.
All right. On that note, we're gonna wrap this episode up. Come to our live show on March 27th.
It's the 27th. Okay, thank you.
At UCB Theater East at 8 o'clock, we've got Baratunda Thurston from The Onion, and we're working on getting some other awesome guests as well.
Yes.
Baratunda is not for The Onion now. Formerly The Onion, formerly The Daily Show, author of How to Be Black. Come see that show and rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe. And Steve, thanks so much. This has been so fun.
Yeah, it's been really great.
I love all your projects, and it's been so fun hearing your point of view on them.
And thanks, vote in midterm elections, everyone. Good night.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.